Everyone in this room is either grieving, has grieved, will grieve, is supporting someone who is grieving, or will support someone who is grieving. Loss is universal. To steal a line from Brianna Mellon, who has graced our fellowship in the past, to live is to stand on the edge of loss. When we consider grief, we generally think of the death of a loved one. Certainly it is that. And yet there are so many forms of loss which bring grief. Loss of roles, abilities, health, mental health, youth, relationships, dreams. What I thought would be possible is no longer. The future I imagined will not happen. It may be a loss of faith in the world. If I just work hard, good things will happen to me. Things we assumed, our assumptive world, can collapse. Sometimes our greatest losses are from things other than death. The grief I talk about today is meant to be broad and to encompass us all. When Lynn invited me to talk about grief today, she said I could go in any direction I wanted. There is so much information about grief, so many heartbreaking stories, so much beautiful inspiration. I decided to focus on three areas: common myths of grief, thoughts on bearing the unbearable, and ways to support others during their grief. It can be hard to talk about grief because how does one gather some commonalities over something so highly unique? I am aware that I run the risk of overgeneralizing. We do not live in a grief-friendly society. There is a relatively new term which I love: toxic positivity. We want things sparkly and shiny and positive and upbeat. We push people to acceptance and moving on. We give people 3 days of bereavement leave and expect that they'll return to work. Amy Lynn, in her book Hereafter, tells of a friend who told her, after her husband of less than 1 year died in his early 30s, "I can't hear about this all the time if it's going to be this sad." There are many myths of grief our culture subscribes to, and this is a problem if we then expect things from ourselves or others that are unlikely to line up with our lived experience. One myth is that grief has a standard look and length. Even though probably no one would outright agree with this statement, many of us get a little uncomfortable when people grieve outside the norm. The truth is, loss is universal, but highly unique. There is a continuum for grievers, from feeling to thinking and or doing. Some people are naturally oriented to their feelings, and they can easily identify them and talk about them. They process their loss through these feelings and often through conversations. They may be very comfortable with tears and have always cried easily. And then at the other end of the spectrum are those who process life more through thoughts or actions. It may be more of a cognitive process than an emotional process. More of a, what am I going to do now, as opposed to, I am so sad. Though certainly thinkers can also be sad. And at this end, we also see the doers who are running marathons in honor of their loved ones, organizing memorials, putting together slideshows. Here are the people who listen to or make music, create art. Most of us fall somewhere in the middle, but we generally have a leaning in one direction or the other. So while there isn't a right way for everyone to grieve, there are things that fit better for each one of us. Keeping this continuum in mind can lead to greater gentleness with ourselves and others. Instead of thinking, how can my dad be over mom's death already? He never cries or talks about her. Perhaps we can shift to, my dad showed his love for mom by making this amazing slideshow. Or, my dad made a beautiful bench which is set in a place to view sunrises, which were our mom's favorite. The strength here is that it focuses on the uniqueness of each person. It draws out their strengths and highlights that they are the expert in their own life and grief. There is no pathology on either end. The problem is not what is naturally there. The rub comes when there is a dissonance between one's inward experience and one's outward expression. Probably the most prevalent myth about grief is that there are 5 stages. Often when I ask a group what they know about grief, someone will toss out the 5 stages. You know them: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And yet no griever I have known has found these fitting or particularly helpful. And no professional I know uses this model. These stages were offered in the 60s as a helpful way for understanding a common reaction to news of one's own terminal illness. I think they make sense in this situation, but we tend to stay attached to them because they are tidy and provide a script for something that is so very messy. What I've seen is that these stages give grievers the sense that they are doing something wrong when they don't follow this trajectory. A more fitting understanding is that we oscillate between 2 camps, between being with our loss, feeling it and understanding what we lost, and getting up in the morning, taking a shower, and getting through the day. How do I make it through this meeting without bursting into tears? How do I get a meal for my kids and have clean clothes in my drawer? How do I get gas in the tank and mow the lawn? We find skills for occasionally shifting away from our deep grief and orienting elsewhere. And we find ways to shift from the tasks of the day and to sit with the deep sadness. We honor the pain and we learn to function in the world. We go back and forth, back and forth. It's not linear, it's not stages. Another myth is that we must say goodbye to our person. When a loved one dies, we may fear that that relationship is gone forever. Death can feel like a broken connection, so we focus on how to stay connected. How do we continue that loving bond? How do I let go of the physical being of my person without letting go of our connection? Questions like, how are you like your mom? How do you carry your dad in your life? How do you live out your sister's values? When do you feel your brother's presence in your life? Can help with that ongoing connection. Death ends a life, not a relationship. And a final myth is that you just have to hang in there until your life returns to normal. You know where I'm going with this. With profound loss, our life does not return to normal. We have to relearn the world and create something new. Expecting to go back to how things were may not be within the realm of possibility. I may need to figure out who I am now. I knew who I was then, but who am I now? What can be created after such deep loss? How do we bear the unbearable? And how can we reflect on this without falling into platitudes and easy answers? In my experience, there is no place in life where the both and concept is more present than with living with loss. It is both and, not either or. If I set up things for myself that I am either grieving or I'm okay, then all hope may be lost. No, I'm grieving and I have meaning in my life. I am so very sad and I experience moments of peace. The world feels broken and I am standing upright. I am angry and I am grateful for what I had. I want you back and I'm grateful that your suffering is over. It is not logically consistent. It does not work on a Hallmark card. Life is both stunningly beautiful and soul-crushingly sad, and we are left holding both. As Carrie Newcomer says in her song, Betty's Diner, despair and hope sit face to face. Here is Kate Braestrup after her husband died in her book, Here If You Need Me. Death alters the reality of our lives. The death of an intimate changes it completely. No part of my life, from the most ethereal notions of God to the most mundane detail of toothbrushing, was the same after Drew died. Life consisted of one rending novelty after another. Still, as time went on, some of those novelties proved to be blessings. And like anyone who has survived the death of an intimate, I had to learn to live with a paradox. If Drew had lived, I would not have gone to seminary, would not be ordained, would not have become a game warden chaplain. There are places that would have gone unvisited and friends I would never have met, friends I now can't imagine doing without. So while on the one hand, there is my darling Drew, whom I will never cease to love and never cease to long for, and on the other hand, there is this wonderful life that I enjoy and am grateful for. I can't make those two realities, what I've lost and what I've found, fit together in some tidy pattern of divine causality. I just have to hold them on the one hand and on the other. Following a major loss, meaning and purpose can be hard to find. There is an area in the field of psychology I am drawn to, and it's called post-traumatic growth. Most are more familiar with post-traumatic stress disorder. Prior to a trauma, we have a certain life narrative, an assumption about how God, the world, ourselves operate. Often this understanding is shaken by traumatic grief and must be reorganized in a new way that holds both pain and meaning. Grief forces questions and protests. Why? This isn't supposed to be how it goes. I can't do this. What happened? We are forced to grapple with unanswerable questions and to do incredibly hard work. Eventually, we are forced to make some choices. We cannot choose whether or not there is suffering in life. We cannot undo the loss. But we can choose our stance in our suffering. This is the spiritual dimension of grief, to turn our pain into something else, maybe even love. It goes without saying that not everyone who experiences loss also experiences growth. It is not a given, it is not automatic, it is not without intention. Positive growth is not about simply looking on the bright side of things. It's not about making lemonade. It does not mean grieving is over. It does not imply being thankful for the adversity. It is not the death itself that we are grateful for. And it does not infer that the loss happened for a reason. For most of us, the truth is we'd toss all this personal growth back in a heartbeat if we could have our loved one back. Steve Leder, Jewish rabbi, drives that important distinction home for me. He writes that growth after loss is never worth it, but he tells us to be sure that it isn't worthless. If you have to go through hell, he writes, don't come out empty-handed. So while I may not find meaning in the death of my loved one, I can find meaning in this new life. Another Jewish rabbi, Harold Kushner, after the death of his 8-year-old son, writes in When Bad Things Happen to Good People, I am a more sensitive person, a more effective pastor, a more sympathetic counselor because of Aaron's life and death than I ever would have been without it. And I would give up all those gains in a second if I could have my son back. If I could choose, I would forego all the spiritual growth and depth which have come my way because of our experiences, and be what I was 15 years ago, an average rabbi, an indifferent counselor, helping some people and unable to help others, and the father of a bright, happy child. But I cannot choose. To bear the unbearable, I believe we also need to give ourselves permission to notice the good that still exists. For some, it can feel like a betrayal of our loved one to not have our pain front and center at all times. Noticing the good that still exists can be about noticing the small, minute details that offer comfort and delight. We are usually guided to remembering the big, epic moments, literal or figurative mountaintop experiences. And yet it is in the everyday moments of pause that often sustain us. Salika Jawad, who lives with leukemia, writes of small pleasures. Noticing these joys is a muscle I've been consciously trying to exercise. training the eye to see them, and training the mind to hold on to them. Finally, I don't know how we bear such loss without a dose of self-compassion. Self-compassion makes it possible. What do I mean by self-compassion? I mean understanding that I am not different from the rest of humanity. I don't have a separate set of rules or expectations. I too will experience pain and suffering, and I too am worthy of comfort and love. We humans can be pretty good at beating ourselves up and being impatient with our imperfections. Self-compassion asks us to consider, how would we treat someone else in this situation? What would that look like? And how can I extend that kindness to myself? Because we cannot simultaneously ignore our pain and direct compassion toward it, we start by acknowledging our painful emotions without immediately trying to fix or push the feelings away. Resisting or denying suffering has the paradoxical impact of increasing it. Self-compassion reduces self-criticism and increases an awareness that we are doing something incredibly difficult. It allows for greater acceptance. When there is kindness, there can be healing. Healing happens when pain is met with compassion. Now, I want to shift gears for a bit and reflect on some ways to support others. This group is great at support. I can learn so much from you, so I'll just mention a couple thoughts. The main thing we do for one another is to show up. We provide a consistent, supportive, kind presence. We do not have the answers to why this tragedy happened or how they will move forward. When someone suffers a profound loss, all we can do is walk beside them. There are no magic bullet words that will ease the pain. Saying, I don't know what to say, is okay. Often it is to say less, listen more. It's important to acknowledge the loss. Students consistently mention how hard it was to return to school and have people avoid them or not mention their loss. You don't have to talk about their person every time you see them, but it's important to say something. Just looking the griever in the eye and acknowledging them is one form of showing up. Grievers often say people avoid eye contact. Don't be afraid to bring up their person, to say their name. We're often afraid we'll make them cry, and most likely they're already thinking about their person anyway. Generally, it's helpful to talk, and it's wonderful to hear our loved one's name. Asking how are you may be an impossible question, so shifting that to asking about something specific can be helpful. How did your meeting go? How is today going? Or what did you do today? Just as there are many types of grievers, there are many ways to support others. So find the way that fits for you. If you aren't comfortable sitting and talking and crying with your friend, mow their lawn, make a meal, clean their house, babysit their kids. Be you. And then remember that they, just like everyone else, will have good days and bad days. If you see the griever having a good day, it doesn't mean that that's the trajectory she's on, or maybe it does. We simply can't know. And I'd like to end with two poems. The first, Blessing for the Brokenhearted by Jan Richardson. Let us agree for now that we will not say the breaking makes us stronger, or that it is better to have this pain than to have done without this love. Let us promise we will not tell ourselves time will heal the wound when every day our waking opens it anew. Perhaps for now, it can be enough to simply marvel at the mystery of how a heart so broken can go on beating, as if it were made for precisely this, as if it knows the only cure for love is more of it, as if it sees the heart's sole remedy for breaking is to love still, as if it trusts that its own persistent pulse is the rhythm of a blessing we cannot begin to fathom, but will save us nonetheless. Another poem, Adrift, by Mark Nepo. Everything is beautiful, and I am so sad. This is how the heart makes a duet of wonder and grief. The light spraying through the lace of the fern is as delicate as the fibers of memory forming their web around the knot in my throat. The breeze makes the birds move from branch to branch, as this ache makes me look for those I've lost in the next room, in the next song, in the laugh of the next stranger. In the very center, under it all, what we have that no one can take away, and all that we've lost face each other. It is there that I'm adrift, feeling punctured by a holiness that exists inside everything. I am so sad, and everything is beautiful.